We're looking at the second letter that Paul wrote to Timothy. We're in chapter 3. And last week we started looking at the section which begins at verse 10. Now you remember that in the first half of this chapter, in verses 1 to 9, Paul warns Timothy that he will meet many false Christians, pseudo-Christians. There will be many people who call themselves Christians, but their so-called Christianity is completely empty. Yes, they're practicing Christians. They go to church, they get involved, they pray prayers that sound good, they can quote the Bible, but when you look at their lives, there's no sign of day-by-day obedience to God's commandments. When you look at their character, they're not godly people. They may talk about loving God, but there's no sign that they really love God at all. If they did love him, they would obey him day by day, and they don't. They love themselves, that's obvious. They love money, you can see that. They love pleasure, and that's very obvious. But there's no sign that they're serious about loving God. They live selfish lives and greedy lives. They please themselves. And they don't change. You don't see them becoming more and more holy, more pure and truthful and kind and humble as the days go by. Their sort of Christianity doesn't involve any self-examination. It doesn't involve any fighting against sin, any repenting, any sacrifice. It doesn't involve painful obedience. Paul describes these false Christians in verses 2 to 4. And then he sums up what's wrong with them fundamentally in verse 5. Having a form of godliness, but denying its power. Form just means an outward appearance, an outward veneer. They've got an outward facade of godliness, but their whole lives deny its power. Their whole lives contradict what they're saying. Their whole lives tell you that their so-called godliness is unreal, it's fake. And Paul goes on to warn Timothy further that these fake Christians will include people who are thought of as Christian leaders. He talks in verses 6 to 9 about people who go around teaching others, and everyone thinks of them as great spiritual leaders. But the fact is that they're con men. They exploit other people. In fact, he says they're no better than Jannes and Jambres, the crooked magicians who work for Pharaoh. They're deceitful. They're unscrupulous. He says they're men of depraved minds. As far as the truth is concerned, they're rejected. That was the situation in Paul's day. And that is the situation today. We have got to be aware that not all the people who go round calling themselves Christians, even evangelical Christians, that not all those people are real. We've got to be clear that not all the people who set themselves up as Bible teachers are real. Paul says that there will be an awful lot of fake, false Christians, so-called, in the Christian world. And there will be a lot of people who are heralded as leaders, but they aren't even Christians, in fact. They may think they are, but they are deceived, and they deceive other people. You know, I can look back on my days at university. Most of you know I was at university in Cambridge at the end of the 70s. And there was a big central Christian union. It was linked with the UCCF, the evangelical organization which links together CUs in different universities and colleges. Well, the Cambridge CU held a big teaching meeting every Saturday evening, and they got in the best known evangelical Bible teachers. The idea was that this Saturday evening meeting was for people who were already Christians. And every Saturday evening, there would be several hundred Christians there. And then there were also individual Christian unions in each of the colleges. You know, that university is made up of lots of different colleges. Altogether, the total number of students who belonged to all the college CUs was around 1,000 in my time. Well, in my time, there were about 10,000 undergraduates in the whole university. So 1 in 10 students was calling himself a Christian and attending the CU. Now, you think about that. 1,000 Christian undergraduates at Cambridge University, which means that it's a three-year course. Every year, more than 300 leaving to go into business, into the media, into politics, into teaching. Remember, these are the people who are going to become leaders in society. I was the one who got left behind. And you've got the same sort of number leaving Oxford each year. And of course, thousands more from other universities. Now, can you imagine the impact it would have on our country if you really did have thousands of godly young Christians committed to living lives of total obedience to Jesus Christ, leaving universities and going into the most influential jobs in the country every year? Our society would be rocked on its pistons. Well, I'm told that the UCCF at various times has tried to find out just what proportion of the students who call themselves Christians while they're at university still have any Christian involvement 5 years after leaving university. In my time, it was about 1 in 7. But 6 out of 7 had abandoned the Christian faith. And what that means is that they were never Christians in the first place. Because God keeps his own people. They don't fall from grace. I think of all those people who were there in those meetings, calling themselves Christians, singing the songs, listening to the Bible teaching. As teenagers or away at college, they had drifted into Christianity. They'd signed up. They'd made a decision at a meeting. They'd joined the CU. They'd learned to talk the talk and pray the prayers that were expected. But their hearts had never been changed. And 5 years on, there was nothing left. And I'm told that since my time, that trend has become even more obvious. I'm told that now it's around 1 in 10 Christian students who press on and are still attending churches 5 years after leaving university. Now, I remember talking to, not very long ago, to one young man who was a leader in the CU at the university he went to. And he was asking my advice. And he was asking me what particularly the Christians in the CU ought to be getting teaching about. And I said, well, I think we need to be going over and over and over again what it means to be a real Christian. The signs of true conversion. How you know whether you're really saved or not. Because, of course, I said. The vast majority of these people in your CU are not real Christians at all. But they think they are. And I pointed out to him the UCCF's own figures. And he just couldn't take in what I was saying. You could see his mind just blanked it out. He said, no. I know, he said, that the Christians in the CU are real. I mean, they're very sincere, and they've all made a decision for Christ, and they're really keen, you know. And whatever I said, I couldn't get it into his head that you can have people who are active and keen and who enjoy the meetings, but who aren't really saved. And that is 9 out of 10 Christian students. Paul is telling us here in this chapter that there are going to be many people who call themselves Christians and who have that outward veneer, and yet there's no saving power at work in them. Now, I've used the example of students because that's where I saw it most clearly. But remember, it doesn't have to be students. You can mix with people from any age group, from any background, who call themselves Christians and who use the right language and who have a form of godliness. And you must remember that those things are no guarantee that they are really saved. In the end, Paul says what every New Testament writer says. The real test of whether a person is saved is, does he, does she live a life of constant, daily obedience to Jesus Christ? Is he or she being changed to become more like Christ? Is he or she actually keeping God's commandments with more and more determination with every day that goes by? I can remember Christian students, so-called, who were so enthusiastic singing worship songs in the CU on Saturday night, and who were equally enthusiastic singing drunken rugby songs in the bar on all the other nights of the week. And for that matter, I can think of dear old ladies, doesn't have to be students, as I say, who attended a ladies' meeting at a church every Thursday morning, and who just loved the hymns. And it was all so lovely. And they said amen so warmly when somebody prayed. But if you visited them in their own home, all you heard was a stream of bitterness against relatives who they thought had let them down, or a stream of gossip against neighbours. A drunken, rowdy Christian? It's a contradiction in terms. A bitter, spiteful, gossiping old Christian? It's a contradiction. It's a nonsense. So I say again, don't be deceived by what people say. The test is what they do, how they live. Can the power of godliness be seen working in their lives? And even more important, don't be deceived about yourself. You know, some of you became Christians 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. At least you signed up then. Back then you decided that that's what you wanted. And you were baptized and you joined the church. And ever since then other people have treated you as a Christian. But now, all these years on, I want you to ask yourself, are you really a Christian at all? If somebody else could watch you, could watch the way you spend your time, could see you when you're at work, could see you when you're at home, could see you when you're with your family, could see you when you're on your own, if somebody could listen to everything you say and watch everything you do, what would they say about you? Would they say, yes, the power of God is in that person. Yes, that person really does live for God. It's obvious that God himself is in him or in her, changing them. And if it's not like that, then face up to the fact you are not a real Christian at all. If you were a real Christian, it would be unmistakable that God's power is at work in you, changing you, making you holy. Face up to the fact you're not a Christian. Your heart's not been changed. The power of God isn't in you. And start crying out to God today to make you a real Christian. Well, we've covered these things many times as we've gone through verses 1 to 9. Paul's painted that picture in verses 1 to 9 of false Christians and false spiritual leaders, and we must take those things as warnings. But then Paul turns to Timothy with these words in verse 10. You, however, it's very emphatic, but you, and he's going to use the same phrase in verse 14, but as for you, but you, I've talked about other people, but now for you, Timothy. What about you? Where does that leave you? And in verses 10 to 16, Paul tells Timothy where that leaves him. I summed up these verses last week in two sentences. Firstly, verses 10 to 13, but you, Timothy, you know what real Christianity is. And then secondly, in verses 14 to 17, but you, Timothy, you must never let go of real Christianity. So we're still with the first of those headings. You, Timothy, you know what real Christianity is. Now, how does Timothy know what real Christianity is? Because he's seen it in Paul himself. Paul says, you, however, know all about my teaching, my way of life, my purpose, faith, patience, love, endurance, persecutions, sufferings. Yes, you've seen the false Christians and the false leaders, Timothy, but you've also seen real Christianity and what it does for a man. You've seen its effect on me. You've seen my life and my character, says Paul, and you can see the difference. Well, last week we went through the marks of real Christianity that Timothy has seen in Paul. Timothy knows all about Paul's teaching and his way of life and his purpose and his faith and his patience and his love and his endurance, persecutions and sufferings. There they are at the end of the list. The things that Timothy has seen in Paul. At the end of the list, Paul emphasizes, and you've seen my endurance, persecutions and sufferings. One of the most obvious features of Paul's life was the suffering he endured and the way he endured it. I went last week through a list of some of the suffering that Paul endured in the course of his Christian life. And if you missed it last week, well, then go back and read Paul's list. It's in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Read there about some of the terrible experiences that Paul's been through since he became a Christian. Read especially the way he's been persecuted. He's had to cope with every imaginable form of persecution. He's been flogged and tortured and stoned and locked up in prison and starved. That's been the way Paul's had to live ever since he became a Christian. It's a terrifying list. It's an almost unbelievable list You can hardly believe that one man could go through so much in the course of 30 years. But there it all is, detailed in black and white, there in 2 Corinthians 11. And Paul is saying to Timothy here, that's what Christianity is. Real Christianity. It leads to suffering of every kind. And especially it leads to persecution. Real Christians are people who have to endure through agonizing experiences which come to them just because they are Christians. Now you see how in the second half here of verse 11, Paul singles out especially the things that happened to him in Antioch, Iconium and Lystra. The persecutions that he endured in those places. He's talking here about things that happened many, many years earlier. It was on his very first missionary journey that Paul went to Antioch, Iconium, and Lystra. And Paul was attacked in each of those three places in turn. You can read in Acts chapter 13 about what happened in the first of those places in Antioch. Acts chapter 13 verse 50. Paul's in Pisidian Antioch, and we read, the Jews incited the God-fearing women of high standing and the leading men of the city. And they stirred up persecution against Paul and Barnabas and expelled them from their region. We don't know exactly what form the persecution took there in Antioch, but we know who was responsible for it. It was the Jewish community. And that means it was Paul's own countrymen. It was the people who he was related to by blood. You know the sort of sense of unity that you get within the Jewish community even today. The sense that a Jew has that he must support every other Jew. That they are really one. It would have been like that for Paul before he was converted. But now something has changed. Paul goes to Antioch, and his own fellow Jews begin to boil with anger against him. And they stir up the God-fearing women of high standing and the leading men of the city. So the Jewish leaders get alongside the upper-class people in the city, the most respectable, civilized people in the city. And they turn them against Paul. And they stir up persecution against Paul. Among those leading people of the city, we're told, were God-fearing women. And what that means is Gentile women who were impressed with the moral standards of Judaism, and so they attached themselves to the synagogue. Well, they were exactly the sort of people who you would have thought would have welcomed Paul with open arms. But no, it wasn't like that. In Antioch, the moral people, the religious people, the enlightened people turn against Paul and they get him thrown out of the area. And so Paul moves on to Iconium, Acts chapter 14, verse 1. And at Iconium, Paul and Barnabas went as usual into the Jewish synagogue. It was the Jewish folk in Antioch who stirred people up against Paul. But Paul goes straight back to the Jewish folk in the next town. He's not given up on them. And there they spoke so effectively that a great number of Jews and Gentiles believed. But the Jews who refused to believe stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brothers. So Paul and Barnabas spent considerable time there, speaking boldly for the Lord, who confirmed the message of his grace by enabling them to do miraculous signs and wonders. But the people of the city were divided. Some sided with the Jews, others with the apostles. And there was a plot afoot among the Gentiles and Jews, together with their leaders, to mistreat them and stone them. But they found out about it and fled to the Lycaonian cities of Lystra and Derbe and to the surrounding country, where they continued to preach the good news. Do you see what happens? Paul's moved on to Iconium. And there in that city you see a whole coalition of people working against Paul, attacking Paul. It starts again with Jewish people who refuse to believe, verse 2, but they stir up the Gentiles, and we're told they poisoned the minds of the Gentiles. Jews and Gentiles, usually on two sides of a religious divide. But one thing they're agreed on in that city, they don't want Paul. And the Jewish people spread lies and slanders against Paul to poison other people's minds. And the Gentiles choose to believe those lies and slanders. Here's Paul, a man of such integrity, a man who's always so concerned to be straight and honest with people. And he knows that in that town people are blackening his name and spreading lies about him. And what's the outcome? Well, all these different folk in that town agree, verse 5, to ill-treat Paul and his companions. In other words, to rough them up, to knock them about, to torture them, and then to stone them. If they could have done, they would have killed Paul there and then. Now don't forget, this was a city in the Roman Empire. And the Romans boasted that they were very strong on justice and the rule of law. They boasted that every Roman citizen was safe. He couldn't be punished without a court case. But when it comes to a man like Paul, well, that's different, isn't it? He may be a Roman citizen, but it doesn't matter. The people of the town are prepared to lynch him on the spot, just to smash his body to bits with stones. And Paul would have died there in Iconium if he hadn't found out about the plot and just got out of town ahead of the lynch mob. And he moves on to a third town, Lystra. And the story is told in chapter 14, verse 8 onwards. And God does a great miracle through Paul in Lystra. A lame man is healed. And then the superstitious crowd starts shouting that Paul and his friends are gods, and they want to make sacrifices to them. Of course, Paul isn't going to have that. And then maybe the crowd are disappointed, and the mood begins to swing against Paul and his friends. And then chapter 14, verse 19. Some Jews arrive from Antioch and Iconium. The people who caused Paul such trouble in Antioch and Iconium have got together. They're not content to drive him out of their own towns. They're pursuing him all the way to Lystra. They're hounding him. And we're told they won the crowd over. And this is what we read. They stoned Paul and dragged him outside the city, thinking he was dead. But after the disciples had gathered round him, he got up and went back into the city. And the next day he and Barnabas left for Derbe. There you are. That's what happened to Paul in three towns, one after another. They throw him out of one. They try to stone him in the second, but he escapes. And then they actually do it in the third, and he's left for dead. You might think that God would have spared him after the first episode. You know, if we had been predicting the story, we might have said, well, God was obviously testing him in the first town. And he came through the test. So God had proved him, and now God will bless him. And in the next town, he'll be accepted, and he'll be allowed to work happily. But it wasn't like that, was it? He suffers in Antioch, and he moves on to Iconium. But there's no escape from the suffering. It becomes more intense. And He moves on from Iconium to Lystra, but there's no escape from the suffering. It becomes more intense. The first town he simply expelled. But in the third town he's stoned till they think he's dead. He's left lying on the ground, unconscious, bruised, broken, bleeding. They think they've killed him. And now back in to Timothy, Paul says to Timothy, you know all about that. You know what happened to me in those three towns. You know that real Christianity means being prepared to suffer not just once as a one-off test, but again and again and again without a break, without respite. And you know, Timothy, that suffering can grow worse and worse, more and more intense, and yet you still have to carry on. Paul comes round out of his coma after being stoned there in Lystra. What does he do? He just carries on to the next town. And what does he do there? We're told in verse 21 he preaches the good news in that city. He's picked himself up off the ground with his body smashed by the stones they've been hurling at him. And he doesn't say, well, I think I'm entitled to 12 months off now to recuperate. He crawls on to the next town and he goes back and carries on preaching where he left off. That is real Christianity. If Timothy knows about what happened in those three towns, Timothy knows how everybody can turn against Christians. In Antioch, it was the respectable, the well-to-do people, the religious people who turned against him. In Iconium, it was the Jewish community, the people who shared his own racial background. In Lystra, it was the superstitious pagan crowd. It made no difference. They could all turn against Christians. You know, we sometimes think, oh, well, it's only sort of nasty, violent, illiterate yobs who are going to throw stones at Christians. But of course, civilized people, nice people, well-educated people, people in the upper echelons of society, at least they'll be respectful towards Christians. Paul knew better than that. Timothy knew better than that. What happened in those three towns proved once and for all that Christians can be the most isolated people in the world. Everybody can turn against them. Real Christianity means that you're prepared to be rejected by the nice, respectable people and the brutal yobs. But you're prepared to be rejected by the people who share your own background and the people who are completely different from you. It means that you can be rejected by your own kinsmen, by your own family. And you accept that. And you carry on despite that. You carry on believing and obeying and serving. And you don't let yourself be diverted from the work that Christ has given you to do. Things happened in those three towns that were just so unfair, so unjust. The lies that were told about Paul, the way that people poisoned other people's minds against him. You know, if I preach the gospel, and if other people quote me fairly, but reject the gospel I'm preaching, then in one sense I accept that as fair. All right, they don't like the gospel I'm preaching. But what if they misquote me? What if they distort everything I've said? And what if they tell lies about me? So that other people never even get a chance to hear what I'm saying. To know the truth about what I stand for. Is that fair? It happened to Paul. People's minds were poisoned against him. He was never given a fair hearing. And the unfairness of the way that the law could simply be overridden. Yes, the law is fine for everybody else. But when it comes to Christians, they're in a different category. We can ignore the law in their case because we all know that Christians are antisocial. That's what happened to Paul in those three towns. Paul says to Timothy, you know that's what real Christianity means. That those things happen to you and you accept them and you carry on doing the will of God. And it's not just that in Antioch and in Iconium and in Lystra things happened that were unfair and unreasonable in terms of the way other human beings treated Paul. There were things that happened that seemed so unfair, so unreasonable, in terms of the way God treated Paul. You know, that last episode in Lystra. It just seems so unfair, doesn't it? It seems so meaningless. God does that awesome miracle. God heals that lame man. And the whole town is amazed. And they're all ready to treat Paul as the best thing since sliced bread. If he had said, I want to be the mayor, they'd have made him the mayor overnight. And you can imagine Paul and his companions holding a praise meeting after that miracle's happened. And they're just praising God that at last he's intervened. At last we've got a real breakthrough. At last we've got real openness here in Lystra. An end to this cycle of persecution and trouble. And 24 hours later, Paul is crawling away from Lystra with his body smashed up by the flying stones. He's crawling away broken and disappointed. Why did God have to raise his hope so high? Why did God have to give him that apparent success if it was all just going to turn to disillusion and hurt? You can imagine the questions that go round and round in Paul's mind. And what does he do? He carries on. Doesn't need to understand why God has done this. No bitterness, no anger against God, no saying, well, until I understand, I just don't feel I can carry on with my ministry. He just carries on believing and living for Christ, and he moves on to the next town and he carries on preaching the gospel. And Paul says to Timothy here, you know all this. You know what kinds of things happened to me in Antioch, Iconium and Lystra, the persecutions I endured. Yet the Lord rescued me from all of them. You know how at the end of them I was still standing, because the Lord gave me grace still to stand. He didn't allow those things to break me or destroy me. You know that I came through them and carried on doing his work. That is real Christianity. Paul says to Timothy, you know what real Christianity is. You know that that is what it involves. Now, I said, didn't I, that these things happened many years earlier. So why does Paul choose these particular sufferings to mention here in 2 Timothy? Rather than all the dreadful things he's been through since then. Well, surely the reason is this. It was back then that Timothy first met Paul. Timothy lived in Lystra. And he was there when Paul arrived in Lystra after being thrown out of Antioch and Iconium. He'll have heard all about that amazing miracle when it happened, if he didn't see it himself. Very likely Timothy will have been there when Paul was stoned and left for dead in Lystra. Perhaps his mum or grandma was one of the believers who helped Paul get to his feet and sent him on his way again. So Paul is saying to Timothy, from the day you met me, you've seen me suffering. Remember the day I came to Lystra? On that day you saw what real Christianity involved. You've never had any illusions, Timothy. It's very likely as a result of Paul's first visit to Lystra that Timothy became a Christian. So Paul is reminding Timothy, you've known from the very beginning that becoming a real Christian and being a real Christian involves facing persecution. Now the false teachers, they didn't believe that. They were specialists in making themselves popular. If there was one thing the false teachers were good at, it was never offending anybody. It was saying what people wanted to say, wanted to hear. It was doing what everybody liked them to do. But Paul says to Timothy, you've watched me, and you know that real Christianity involves saying things that are going to lead to trouble. Real Christianity means going right against the flow of society. It means saying things that may upset and offend your own family, the people closest to you, the people who share your own background. You know that real Christianity means never toning down the demands of Christ in order to keep other people happy. Real Christianity means being prepared to face persecution at any time. That's been my story, says Paul. And then he says in verse 12, and in fact, everyone who wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. There are still many people around today who will tell you that if we as Christians only handle things right, that everybody will like us. That if we only make our church work in the right way and have the right furnishings and the right program of activities and show a proper concern for the community, that we'll win applause. Paul says it's not true. Any Christian who is determined to live a godly life will be resented. He'll be resented by the world, and he'll be persecuted. All who want to live godly in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. Jesus said, beware when all men speak well of you. It isn't a sign of spiritual health. It isn't a sign that we've got things right if everybody speaks well of us. Paul says, if you live godly in Christ Jesus, if that is your determination, you must expect to face persecution. Well, God, give us grace to search ourselves, to discover whether we are real Christians, to discover whether we understand what it means to live a godly life in Christ Jesus.